Hello, hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another episode of the Daily Friend Show. I am your host, Nicholas Lorimer. Today, I'm joined by Michael Morris. Michael, how are you doing?
Very well, thank you. A bit chilly and wet today in Cape Town. Winter is lingering, but otherwise in fine fettle. Thank you.
Excellent, excellent. And of course, we're also joined today by Saragon, who has had to seek refuge in a different room from normal. So if you are watching on YouTube, you will see that the background is a little bit different. Sarah, how are you?
Yes, not my style of shirt, but nevertheless, no, I'm well, and it's lovely and mild and warm in Joburg. What can I say? The sky's blue. The air is full of dust.
Indeed, it is much to my despair. Right, let's get into the first news story of today. And last week, I asked the question on the show, how long could it be that the ANC could sort of blunder forward with the National Health Insurance Scheme (NHI) without sort of bending to the reality that the resistance was far stiffer than they wanted, that parts of it were being stripped out by the courts. And that they really just didn't have the support behind it in Parliament. After all, I think both the EFF and the MK, who would be needed in order to get the thing over the line if the ANC wanted to change anything or about NHI, are not going to cooperate, that the DA and the Freedom Front Plus will probably oppose anything to do with it. So, yes, it's been passed into law, but it looks increasingly shaky. Well, it looks like the ANC's decided that it's time to play hardball. At least Health Minister Aaron Motsoaledi, as seems to be under that impression. He said over the last few days that he said there is a particular provision of the NHI that is an absolute non-negotiable, and that is that private medical aids in their current form must be scrapped, and that no price is too high. In fact, he would even say that they should collapse the Government of National Unity in order for NHI to continue on in its current form, essentially abolishing most of the private medical insurance industry. Now, our esteemed and mighty CEO leader John Endres put out a press release just pointing out that one of the absolutely disastrous consequences of blundering forward with NHI and essentially abolishing private health insurance will be to seriously put at risk the country's fragile tax base. In his press release, John pointed out that there are 862,000 individual taxpayers whose income is over 750,000 rand. This group of people contributes more than 58.6% of all personal income tax. It's also pretty reasonable to assume that almost every single one of these people has private health insurance and considers this extremely important to their quality of life. And if you abolish that and basically throw them into a government-controlled system, many of them may very well consider leaving. And in fact, those are the people who are best placed to do so. And that would cause a horrific blow to our income tax. Take something like more than 20% of tax revenue could be affected by those people leaving. So Motsoaledi here is playing with fire. Not only is he threatening the stability of the Government of National Unity by blundering ahead with this, but he's also threatening the country's financial well-being. Sara, let me start with you. It's kind of extraordinary, isn't it?
Well, as one of our commenters points out, he's an ideologue. He's also not the sharpest scalpel in the OR, shall we say. And he seems to bristle when there's real criticism, which being a member of cabinet is not a good thing because it's probably only ever criticism. I think this might well be one of the few hills to really die on from an opposition point of view, because you've got the private sector in every respect on your side. You've got the fact that in the aspiration to belong to a medical aid, because people know what the benefit is of having access through a medical aid to decent medical cover, is huge thing. And when Ramaphosa signed this into law just before the election, I think there's great announcements, such as bells and whistles, parades and circuses, and the whole trip, as is the signing of this compact that requires those signatories to the compact to approve, essentially approve the NHI, which is what stopped the business sector in its tracks. It's extraordinary because it just did not at all go down in the way the government expected to, or the way the ANC expected to. So it's not a highly popular move. It keeps being presented as the universal health, you know, health system, free universal health care. We have roughly free universal health care. There's a difference between having it and having a bad version of it. And to improve healthcare in this country, whatever method you do is going to rely on the quality and expertise involved in the private sector. Now, if the ANC cannot get over the ideology of this and do what is practical, like, as we've discussed before, fixing hospitals and employing good people and stopping Tembisa hospital-style corruption, this could really blow up. And I think I think if I were in the GNU, I would go back into opposition because of it.
No, exactly. NHI is one of the most disastrous policy ideas of the government of the last couple of years, and that's a crowded field. There's a lot of competition there, and yet I think in many ways it continues to be one of the biggest threats to South Africa's future well-being, because it threatens essentially to destroy the middle class in so many ways. Michael, my thought is that the president actually, I think, really needs to make clear whether Motsoaledi is just sort of speaking for himself as the health minister, or speaking for the GNU as a for the ANC within the GNU. It is kind of amazing that, you know, as Sara says, this NHI has got all this resistance against it. It's too expensive. It's got all these major problems with it. It's not as popular as that, you know, the ANC thought it would be, this big vote winner, I think, which is why they announced it just before the election, why the president signed it just before the election. And yet, even as it turns out to not really be giving them much benefit, they're just sort of blundering ahead. What do you make of this?
Yeah. As we were saying before the show, I'm absolutely certain there's some people in the ANC who probably had a fit when they saw the sort of precision with which Motsoaledi said, you know, we will push this through even at the expense of the GNU. Smart people in the ANC must realize that the ANC's future is actually at stake if the GNU doesn't work and doesn't deliver the goods, at least to some extent. And for that to happen, there's got to be very creative ways to make compromises and find a way around some of these sort of hard and fast positions that they've announced, which they're now having to presumably retreat from. I imagine gingerly, they will do it gingerly, but they're just not playable for all the reasons that you've said. And, you know, here, once more, we see a policy that speaks of the, Sara has used the term, policies that are cured in pickled in aspic, dating back to, you know, the 1960s and even further before that, and which have very, very little relevance to the way most people want to live in South Africa and the rest of the world today, that we all want modern middle-class lives with all the comforts. It's not without challenges, but these are the very basic things people want. And they don't want substandard state services that are costing them an arm and a leg and not living up to what they see on television and on their cell phones, which they know is accessible. They can see poor people elsewhere in the world getting these things, and they want it here. It is astonishing that he should be so sort of visibly ideological and stubborn about it. I don't think it's going to do him any good. I think we might have spoken about this last week. It's very encouraging that both business and the broader health sector has made clear exactly why it is opposed to NHI. in AGI and why. I think Sara's point is absolutely crucial. You know, we essentially have universal health coverage, but a bad version of it. I think we're aware of Sara, and I think that's exactly right. There's no reason why we can't have a good version of it. We've just got to have proper managers, proper procedures, scrap corruption, make sure things are done properly, nurses who are doing their jobs, doctors doing their jobs, and so on. That's really what people want. And that's why they've turned increasingly, as soon as they can afford it, they turn to the private health sector, which does actually deliver these things. So yeah, quite a shocking statement from him. But come back to your question actually to me, Ramaphosa should actually make it clear, you know. And if he were wise, he would recognize that it's in the ANC's interest that he makes it clear. But let's see.
Yeah, I hope that, the DA in particular, who have been anti-NHI, are making it clear behind the scenes that this is a very big problem for them and not just getting along to go along.
Yeah.
You know, I think, you know, there may be strategic considerations for them as to why they might not want to have this fight, at least for now in public. But I very much hope that behind the scenes they are putting the pressure on this one, because this is not, you know, this is not a small fish. Even if NHI remains sort of half implemented and is kind of, you know, not properly funded and all these sort of things, I think the damage is still going to be very real. And I don't think you can just sort of sweep this thing under the carpet and just kind of try to muddle through.
No.
Sara, any final thoughts?
No.
Just, you know, looking at the medical aid specifically, I mean, this has got to be one of the many areas of unconstitutional provision in the Act, because it completely interferes with how business is conducted, what businesses you run, the right to trade, etc., and falls under that. But the bearing in mind, what the ANC needs to bear in mind, of course, is that that middle class that has access to medical aids, that part of the middle class that supports the ANC works for government. Everyone in the private, in the public sector belongs to a medical aid, and you cannot possibly say, well, we can keep the government medical aids going, but we can't keep the private sector going. I mean, it's so shot full of holes. And I think the problem with it, because the ANC, not as the business sector had realized quite late, has paid very little attention to changes, partly because the Act is so flawed that I'm not sure it could get its, you know, I think it really does have to be scrapped. That's a very real thing. Its own a considerable niche of its own support relies on medical aids, in the same way that the private sector does. I can't believe this didn't land like a lead balloon for a lot of ANC people.
I'm sure. I was talking to a couple of us were talking for colleagues with some visiting American students last week who wanted to chat to us. And one of the points we made was that the very considerable improvements that the ANC administration brought to South Africa in the period immediately after 1994 under Mandela and to some extent under Thabo Mbeki, those improvements, in fact, and the access, and just, you know, having lifted the limits on access to education and all the rest of it, produced a generation of people who, in fact, were now almost preordained to be antithetical to everything that the ANC stood for. They don't want the state, centralized state planning and being told what to do and what they can and can't do. They you know, it's a condition of their new lives, the improved lives, that they in fact want all the things that that these things are obstacles to. So yeah, it's very ironic.
Indeed, NHI, bad for the country, bad for the opposition, bad for the ANC. I can only, you know, it gets very difficult to see any reason for supporting it other than either blind, willful, disconnected from reality kind of commitment to centralized state control, or at the very least, maybe it's just simply there wants to be people getting their hands on resources. Losing the private sector, which is, of course, also a very bad reason to support NHI. Anyway, let's move on to our next story. And this is actually just sort of a collection of things that are going on at the moment. But there's sort of a bit of a theme between them about, I guess, the relationship between citizens and municipalities. So we've had yet another nasty fire in the city of Johannesburg, in the center of the city. A three-story building that was hijacked a while ago and was massively overcrowded caught fire on Sunday, and four people died and three were seriously injured. Also, 300 people who were living in that building have been displaced and are being housed in shelters. The property was absolutely filled from top to bottom with illegal electricity connections. And after the fire, city power officials confiscated all of the electrical cables from the building to try and prevent anyone from returning there. The city of Johannesburg insists that it does have a plan to address the hijacked buildings crisis. Of course, there have been a number of horrible fires in the city of in the center of Joburg in exactly similar circumstances, which have killed people. The new mayor of Johannesburg said that this was a complicated issue that's been around for a long time. He said, "We have been engaging with our national and provincial government to help us find a sustainable solution. And one of the biggest problems we are experiencing is that those buildings are constantly being hijacked by criminal syndicates, which requires us to also get law enforcement." Sorry, I need to cough there. The mayor said, though, however, that he was 90% done with a strategy for how to tackle the hijacked buildings, which seems to be, according to the news reporting, reclaiming the buildings and releasing them to the private sector for development, which sounds pretty good, but you know, the actually doing it is the difficult part, and this is not the first time things like this have been said. At the same time, there's also been a recent court ruling in Ekurhuleni in the East Rand in Gauteng, where the municipality was sued back in 2010, and the case kind of went on for a while. After a motorcyclist hit a pothole near his home that was filled with water after a rainstorm, and suffered very severe injuries from hitting that pothole. He's then sued the municipality essentially for damages, and he died a year later. It's not clear whether it was actually necessarily connected to his accident, but I'm sure it didn't help. The High Court in Johannesburg has just awarded his estate R1 million, which is not the full amount he asked for, but it's quite close to it. Saying that the municipality had not provided, had an absence of evidence to support its bare denials that it had any sort of responsibility to fix the roads, and that the municipality had a legal duty to maintain public roads properly in order to, you know, prevent this kind of thing happening. And this, to me, suggests that maybe there could be a greater scope for individual citizens to open up the taps and essentially sue municipalities more and more for the damages they suffer as a result of poor governance. Sara, what do you make of these two stories together? This is, I think, the continuing dysfunctional relationship between the municipalities across the country, particularly the metros, and citizens who live in them.
Well, I think, particularly for Johannesburg, it's very bad news, and the new mayor's not helping. Not so much because he underpromised. Underpromising is probably a good thing in the current climate, but because there's a still a complete lack of understanding. I mean, why they were so desperate to get him in to replace the guy who preceded him is not entirely clear. We've had the disaster of which you talked about Lillian and Ngoyi Street not being repaired and corruption, etc., because of the gas explosion. And it seems like what the ANC municipally as well as provincially is doing, which is different to nationally, is its eye is on very much an ANC-run environment when they don't actually have the numbers, so, but they're hooking up with the more left-wing parties to try and bolster their fortunes in the municipal elections of 2 years' time, 2026. And the problem is, you know, he was very honest in saying that, you know, they're going to really go for doing things in the areas where their supporters live. There's only one problem. Their supporters don't do everything in their lives around the square block in which they live and vote. So the fixing of the streets, the dealing with what are now a load of very dangerous buildings, having essentially really dealt with the private sector badly when it tried to refurbish downtown, nothing really is changing the way of the nature of the administration that is running Johannesburg now. So how I have absolutely no confidence in what sort of plan the mayor has, not necessarily what the plan may consist of, but the fact that it's being implemented. There's no sense of a breath of fresh air. There's no sense of really, they're going to sort of lease it to the private sector. I mean, a lot of these buildings, some of them were private sector buildings that have been hijacked and that have been taken over, which you know, who's going to want to take those over? And then many of them are beyond the point of being able to do anything with. They've just got to be pulled down. So the only plan that the ANC can deal with is pulling down those buildings, getting people out of those buildings and pulling them down left, right, and center. But I think, and you notice it more and more in articles that deal with buildings, with evictions, with people taking over, is the fact that the ANC has now been hoisted by its own petard when it came into power of making not only people who occupy buildings have greater power than they had before, but the municipality is obliged before it does anything to find alternative accommodation for them. And Joburg City Council's just not been up to that task. And I think it's discovering that, you know, the sort of human rights element of letting occupiers have rights to things isn't that simple, doesn't quite work that way, and is now an impediment to progress. And this is not in any way denying the severity of the problem, but the way to have dealt with the problem in the first place was to really, you know, put obligations on the landlords, but also to make it, you know, do not give people rights just by virtue of occupation, because then nothing happens. And we've got an incident close to where I live in the suburban setting, where exactly that is hamstringing things. So certainly in a place like Johannesburg, there's been no development in the last while that is in any way given confidence that things may happen. Although I have to say that a pothole that is probably waist high in an area near me after years of complaining has just been repaired after 4 or 5 years.
There we go. We're turning around things.
Most people in it, you know. I don't know.
I'm always struck by these hijacked building stories because they always remind me of the fact that because in many ways it's simply a case of property rights not being properly enforced. And in this case, it is literally killing people who are being crammed into these buildings. And these buildings are, you know, essentially unsalvageable until you have proper law enforcement because they just get hijacked. I'm sure, you know, while I think City Power is very confident here that by simply removing the electricity cables, they will prevent reoccupation of that building. I don't think that's going to be the case at all, unfortunately. Okay. And I suspect people will be back soon. Michael, what do you make of all this?
I think, I mean, two things that leap out at me in regard to this building story in particular. The first was the mayor saying this is a problem that's been around for a long time. Well, there you have an encapsulation of exactly what the problem has been. Is that, you know, there's been an issue and it just hasn't been confronted and dealt with properly. And the other thing, which relates directly to the point you just mentioned, Nicholas, that is the EWN tweet or post on X, that the burnt down building was called Inkanini by residents. In isiZulu, it means place of stubborn defiance. So, and there's quoting a woman here to say, Tolokele Dlamini says, a longtime resident says, they call it that because the municipality has tried to evict them a number of times before, but they always return. Now, you know, one can turn all the venom and the vituperation and the anger at these people who are looking for, you know, finding solutions to their housing in unconventional ways. The fact is, urbanization is really the one fundamental truth of modern South Africa. It's people want to be in cities and they're going to be there. It's where the city can turn around and say this is inconvenient, it's difficult, it's all the rest of it. That's not going to alter the fact that people are going to come. The city of Cape Town has this, and there's a curious truth about it, which I remember as a journalist covering the city, telling young reporters who always wanted to see problems in the city as an indication of the city's inability to do things. A city without those problems is a city in stasis or a city in decline. If you're a growing, attractive, thriving place, you're going to be attracting people. And that is true to some extent, even of Johannesburg. We know it's an economic powerhouse. People in the countryside make a choice. You know, are we going to stay here and just die sort of quietly of starvation, or we get to get ourselves either to Joburg or to another big center. Cape Town's probably a bit far away from people living in the north, but certainly for Eastern Cape and the Northern Cape and the Western, you know, other parts of the rural parts of the Western Cape, Cape Town is a huge magnet, and so is Gauteng. So urbanization is the key thing. And I can't remember now, it was you, Nicholas, who mentioned property rights. And my first thought is, you know, of cities and of sophisticated imaginative solutions to all these kinds of problems. And it's a land reform problem in the urban setting. The ANC, unfortunately, has squandered years, hundreds of millions of rands and heaps of goodwill in focusing on expropriation without compensation and tying it to a sort of scapegoating of a small and vital farming economy. And pretending that that is what the real problem is, whereas in fact the real challenge has all this time been, how do we make accommodation, create accommodation for people in cities in a way that the city can continue to be sustained. You've got to use the private sector, the private sector's property market has got to be somehow involved in that. I don't know what the solutions are, but I do know that, and the Cape Town situation is perhaps worth looking at, is that you've got to deal with crime and grime on the pavement, from the pavement up. That's some other thing the city can do. Law enforcement, you've got to make sure every little thing is properly applied. It's not a question of keeping people out. You just make sure if they come, there's certain things they can't do. That's just how it is. It's got to work like that. And the city itself has got to be a working economic proposition. I mean, it's amazing that while we're talking about these buildings, we ran a story on the Daily Friend just last week about Cape Town CBD. So it's a small, I think 1.6 square kilometer footprint of the CBD, having upped property development of more than 7.2 billion rand last year, exceeding the total of the year before, 2022, by 3.7 billion. So, you know, this is not providing housing for poor people, obviously, but it's part of a proposition that is, you know, the city is can function, we can grow investment, and this is part of getting the wherewithal to actually deal with the very great problems that come with this constant and rapid urbanization, poor people coming to the city because this is where they can actually find a better life. So all these things, you know, you've got to fix that pothole because that's part of making sure that you're also dealing with the buildings, with people coming, with, you know, the whole proposition.
If you wanted a denser, more efficient city, you need to, I think, destigmatize living in apartments. And if you want to destigmatize living in apartments, you have to run the city well, because apartment buildings are very susceptible to the exact kind of urban decay that we've seen in the center of Joburg. And if we had basically more rich people living in the center of Joburg, it would probably be good for everyone. I know there's been a lot of studies actually that have been done recently in first world countries, in the US in particular, which have found that if you actually build housing for wealthier people, everyone's housing costs go down because the market is better supplied. It's not just, you know, so this is not just we must just protect the middle class thing. This is actually genuinely good for all South Africans.
Yeah.
A hijacked building makes no one's life better, even if it temporarily provides accommodation to some of the poorest people in the country. It's a horrible place where people die in fires. This is not the way to solve things. All right. Very quickly, last story. Chief Justice Raymond Zondo, who I think has been a pretty good Chief Justice, and of course was the chair of the Zondo Commission, which looked into to basically the corruption under Jacob Zuma, has he's going to be retiring soon as Chief Justice at, I think, at the end of August. So he's been doing a lot of interviews reflecting on his time as Chief Justice. And he was asked recently in an interview about when the Constitutional Court found Jacob Zuma in contempt of court for refusing to appear before the State Capture Commission of Inquiry. And he said that this was quite simply the bottom line, that they had no other choice. They had to find him in contempt of court. And that he was shocked that someone who had served as the president of the country would defy an order of the Constitutional Court. And this actually brings me to a point I've always thought about Raymond Zondo. While I think Raymond Zondo is a very good man and has done a lot of good things for this country, particularly, you know, including the important stuff about value for money in the Zondo Commission report, he's always struck me as sort of slightly naive in that he got shocked quite a lot, I think, firstly, by the scale of corruption in the State Capture report, even though I think a lot of that had been quite obvious for a while. And also not thinking that Jacob Zuma would do, you know, the constitutionally delinquent thing. You know, he's not a guy with a lot of honor, Jacob Zuma. So I'm not sure why Zondo was so surprised by it. But anyway, Farah, your thoughts on Zondo? I think, you know, he has been one of the more consequential figures in our politics in recent years. And I think he's done a lot of good for the country.
I agree with your assessment of him. I think being sort of pushed into the Zondo Commission role gave him a legacy that he might not otherwise have had. I think he's generally a good man, but I think there is a naivety. He didn't in the period, although he wasn't actually, he hasn't been Chief Justice for very long. Nothing seems to have helped in the last decade or so with regard to the administration of justice and things like the master's office and things like that. And that's what the Chief Justice is there for. Hopefully his replacement, Mandisa Maya, will be there for long enough to get to grips with those sorts of issues. But the Zondo Commission definitely, I think, gave an unwilling, probably somewhat uncomfortable man through the sheer volume of evidence, time, corruption, malfeasance and everything. But I think he's probably the only man in South Africa who would have been surprised by Zuma's flouting of the law. And maybe that's why the commission actually ended up producing as much as it did, because he didn't know what to expect and was just bold. You know, the more he was exposed to it, the more the tougher he became. But I'm not sure he would have left quite that legacy without having to head the commission.
Final thoughts, Michael, before we close up.
I mean, I agree with what you've said. On one hand, there's something quite attractive about the fact that he's not this sort of jaded, overly sophisticated man who knew what he was dealing with and all the rest of it. To me, the most important thing was his saying when he was discussing how he was surprised and shocked by the defiance and that a former president of the country would actually defy the Constitutional Court. The most important thing for me was his saying that when it came to grappling with what to do, it was very simple. And he said, what will be done is what is normally done in the courts when somebody defies an order of court. And that's a wonderful thing for him to have said. And it sets a very, you know, not necessarily a high bar, but it sets the bar where it ought to be. This is how judges approach such things, and that there was no political consideration at all. But now we just wait for the Zondo Commission's recommendations to be properly enacted.
Wouldn't that be nice? But I think we may have to wait a while, yes, until the politics changes a bit. Anyway, Chief Justice Zondo, a good man, who has definitely done good for our country. And It's going to be sad to see him as the Chief Justice. But anyway, that's all the time we have for today. We hope you found the show interesting. We will, of course, be back tomorrow on the Daily Friend Show. Cheers, everyone, and have a wonderful day.